From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
America has traveled and is still traveling a long, hard road to redeem this commitment to equal justice. It is a path haunted by the ghosts of slavery, civil war, Jim Crow, and internment. A path littered with desecrated churches and synagogues, persistent intolerance, and bigotry.
Bill Landley is appointed acting assistant attorney general, and we speak with Gary.
Now, does that?
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
America has traveled and is still traveling a long, hard road to redeem this commitment to equal justice. It is a path haunted by the ghosts of slavery, civil war, Jim Crow, and internment. A path littered with desecrated churches and synagogues, persistent intolerance, and bigotry.
Bill Landley is appointed acting assistant attorney general, and we speak with Gary Webb. He's resigned from the San Jose Mercury News. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton yesterday named Bill Landley acting assistant attorney general for civil rights. The move bypasses the Senate's role in confirming administration nominees. Under the president's constitutional power to make appointments while the Senate is in recess. Defense Secretary William Cohen ordered all 1.5 million men and women in uniform to be inoculated against anthrax, citing a growing global threat of biological warfare. Treatment involves 6 shots over 18 months, then annual boosters. Iraq, Russia, and as many as 10 other nations are believed to have weapons capable of delivering anthrax. I don't believe the Food and Drug Administration has approved the vaccinations. And many have said that they believe that so many soldiers got sick during the Persian Gulf War because of a combination of issues possibly involving their inoculations or the pills they took. President Clinton welcomed Iranian President Khatami's weekend offer of a thoughtful dialogue with the United States, one of the first signs of diplomatic warming between the two nations in nearly 20 years. But Washington is waiting to see whether Tehran's religious leaders, who have so far been silent, attack the initiative. UN investigators in Congo were forced to return to Kinshasa after villagers demonstrated outside their camp in Bandaka, site of an alleged massacre of Rwandan Hutu refugees during former Zaire's recent civil war. Security concerns may bring an early halt to the much-delayed inquiry. A Pentagon commission is urging that all services begin to follow the Marines' policy of segregating the sexes in boot camp and that the Army, Navy, and Air Force make their basic training tougher. The report by the panel, which was appointed after the Army sex abuse scandal, is due out today. A judge in the Mike Espy case dismissed 3 of 39 charges after defense lawyers argued that the law in question, the 1907 Federal Meat Inspection Act, didn't apply to the former agriculture secretary. Those 3 charges were the only ones that required a prison sentence of at least 1 year each. Virginia Republican Senator John Warner says U.S. troops need to stay in Bosnia another 2 years in order to complete peacekeeping efforts there. Warner says after talking with senior U.S. and NATO officials, he's convinced that a U.S. pullout at the end of the present mission would risk damaging the NATO alliance. American troops are scheduled to come home in about 6 months, but President Clinton is considering an extension of the mission and says he'll make a decision soon. Closing arguments by Terry Nichols' defense attorneys are due to wrap up today, but no matter what the outcome of his federal trial, he'll face murder charges in Oklahoma. Charges also will be filed against Timothy McVeigh for the April 95 bombing. McVeigh is appealing his federal conviction and death sentence earlier this year for the bombing that killed 168 people and injured more than 500 others. Nichols faces a similar sentence if convicted. After an emotionally charged debate, the New Jersey Senate narrowly voted yesterday to override Governor Christine Todd Whitman's veto of a measure that bans what abortion opponents call partial birth abortion. The General Assembly voted overwhelmingly to override the Republican governor's veto 2 weeks ago. Minutes after the New Jersey State Senate vote, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a constitutional challenge to the new law in federal district court. The new law would place the first restrictions on abortion in New Jersey since the United States Supreme Court legalized abortion in 1973. Microsoft Corporation may be walking a fine line as it appeals an order to stop requiring a computer maker to include its internet software if they want to license Windows 95, this according to antitrust experts. Microsoft filed the appeal Monday in Washington, D.C., saying it would sell stripped-down versions of the operating system to comply with the preliminary injunction issued Thursday by U.S. District Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson. But an official with the Justice Department, which has sued Microsoft over its business practices, says the company's latest actions fail to comply with the federal judge's decree. Microsoft says flatly the current version of Windows 95 won't work properly without the browser. The Justice Department claims Microsoft violated the agreement barring anti-competitive practices in the software market. The government sought a $1 million a day fine if the company refused to obey a contempt finding. And today in Washington, President Clinton will hold his year-end news conference. That's some of the news at this hour. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. Chinese-American Bill Lan Li was sworn in as acting head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division yesterday after being named the top civil rights enforcer over the wishes of some Republican senators. By appointing Li acting Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, President Clinton sought to avoid inciting fury in the Senate over a threatened recess appointment that the Senate could not have acted on. Clinton will try again next year to win confirmation for Li, who can serve indefinitely in the acting position. Republicans opposed to the nomination said they disagreed with Clinton's move. They vowed intense scrutiny of Li's performance and said the decision would become an issue in 1998 congressional elections. The chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, pledged to avoid retribution against Li. Clinton announced the appointment at an Oval Office ceremony, accompanied by Li and Li's family. Also, Attorney General Janet Reno was there, along with congressional supporters of Li. Clinton said he aimed to renominate Li early next year and hoped eventually to strike the acting portion of Li's title, but Li's authority would not be diminished in the meantime. Bill Lan Li also spoke at the ceremony.
America has traveled and is still traveling a long, hard road to redeem this commitment to equal justice. It is a path haunted by the ghosts of slavery, civil war, Jim Crow, and internment. A path littered with desecrated churches and synagogues, persistent intolerance, and bigotry. However, our progress as a nation has been marked by a succession of civil rights laws, stand posts that rise above political party and endure as lasting bipartisan achievements.
Bill Lan Li speaking yesterday at the ceremony at the Oval Office. We're joined right now by Frank Wu, who's an associate professor at Howard University Law School. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's good to be with you today.
Well, why don't we go through how it is we've come to this point where Bill Lan Li has been named the acting assistant attorney general in charge of civil rights?
Well, I think something very fascinating has happened. It's all partisan politics. You know, when Bill Li was first nominated for this position, he enjoyed wide bipartisan support. Let me give you two examples. Senator Al D'Amato of New York and Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon, hardly radicals, mainstream Republicans, endorsed him, supported him. Richard Reardon, for example, wrote a letter to the Senate saying that although he had been sued by Mr. Lee on numerous occasions, he thought he was a fine lawyer and well qualified for the job. So Bill Lee had bipartisan support. Not only that, he was known for building coalitions. Here's someone who worked for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, founded by the late Thurgood Marshall. But I think many people were surprised when he was introduced to find out that he wasn't African American, he was Asian American. Here's someone who is engaged in the work that many people talk about, building bridges, building coalitions, racial healing. So he had wide support across political parties and across racial groups. What happened then? Affirmative action. The right wing decided to take Bill Lee and make an example of him. And led by Clint Bullock of the Institute for Justice, would send him along to the full Senate floor for a vote. They decided that within the Judiciary Committee, a handful of senators would deny the president his choice of a nominee, would not even send it onto the Senate. So it's important to understand that Bill Lee was never rejected by the Senate. He was never even considered. One of the things that President Clinton has talked about is sending his name up again in the spring to get the Senate to actually confirm him for the full position. And I think this is very interesting because it shows that by using procedural maneuvers, that there's something partisan, something ugly going on here. And because of a disagreement, what the Senate has said is that we will deny a well-qualified person a position enforcing civil rights. You know, it's really ironic. They talk about qualifications and how we should have qualified people, and here they are turning down someone who everyone conceded perfectly well-qualified, no blemish in his record, no personal scandal, nothing. The only reason they turned him down was because they thought that he would enforce the civil rights laws the way that Bill Clinton wanted them enforced, which is hardly radical.
You know, it's interesting, Professor Wu, the statement we just ran from Bill Lan Lee. It was a very strong statement. It wasn't unapologetic.
That's right. I think it's significant because as he steps into the role of enforcing the civil rights laws, of which affirmative action is but a small part, he takes on great responsibility. If he and his lawyers do not do a good job, as he mentioned, the promises of equal protection and these lofty phrases that we all hold near and dear as citizens, and we sometimes take for granted, they're meaningless. If people are allowed, employers, people who run hotels, shops, stores, neighbors, if they're allowed to get away with racial discrimination, gender discrimination, discrimination on the basis of disability, and all sorts of other reasons that we have decided as a society are improper. But we all know people do this, not just historically, but today in real situations, people still do this. So we need someone to enforce these laws. And if he does not enforce these laws, the laws are meaningless. They're just a bunch of words. And so I think it's important that we recognize that here is someone who's going to step forward, but it's important also to look at his history. His claim to fame is settling cases. He reaches principled compromises. Look at his significant victories. And what you will find is that what he did was he worked out agreements with the people that he was suing. Agreements where instead of pointing fingers and blaming, what they did was they agreed. They agreed to change their programs. They agreed to hire more racial minorities. They agreed to hire women. They agreed to look at their training programs, retention. And so we're making real progress. So here's someone comes out strong and reaches a compromise. I think that's ideal. That's what we're looking for in civil rights enforcement.
We're talking to Professor Frank Wu, associate professor at Howard University Law School. It's interesting when you talk about what his specialty is. I was looking at a piece from Associated Press about something that has just happened in Detroit, the settlement of a discrimination lawsuit. And it says that Detroit Edison Company has tentatively agreed to settle a discrimination lawsuit filed on behalf of 3,500 minority employees. Under the deal, the utility giant would pay between $17.5 million and $65 million in damages to black employees who sued after they were offered voluntary termination packages starting in 92. An oversight board also will be set up to scrutinize company employment policies and the rehiring of minority workers. The lawsuit is the company's second major discrimination lawsuit. And this sounds like the kind of case that Bill Lanley has taken on and the kind of settlements that he has worked on over many years.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, here's someone who's a pragmatist. It's really ironic how the Senate characterized him as a real radical, because if you ask real radicals, real leftists, Bill Lee, and I respect him greatly, but he's hardly a radical. He's a mainstream civil rights lawyer. And ask anyone who's ever been involved in any kind of lawsuit, especially a discrimination lawsuit. The last thing you want is to be tied up in the courts for 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 years to have to pay lawyers and have to go through the stress and the uncertain results. It's much better for everyone concerned and for society especially if we all sit down and reach some reconciliation and say, well, here is a practice that a company is engaged in that's wrong. That's wrong. It's morally wrong. It's illegal. And if they recognize that and are willing to compensate the people that they've harmed and, as importantly, change the way they do business in the future, that's real progress. And that is exactly the type of case that Bill Lee was known for taking when he was with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And I hope it's the approach that he pursues with the Justice Department.
Professor Wu, you mentioned that affirmative action is only actually a small part of what he would be doing as head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. Can you explain the civil rights laws that he would be enforcing?
Well, his
I should say that he will be enforcing.
That's right. That's right. And I hope he'll be enforcing them as vigorously as his speech just 24 hours ago suggested that he would be. The Justice Department's civil rights branch has responsibility for enforcement of a wide range of civil rights laws, all the laws that you and I are familiar with, the laws that prohibit employers from discriminating, for example, the laws that prohibit if you check into a hotel, that prohibit them from discriminating, the laws that prohibit discrimination at schools, at the workplace. He's also responsible for prosecution of hate crimes. You know, there's been a dramatic rise in hate crimes, and it's his division that goes out and finds the wrongdoers and prosecutes them, and that's a very important task as well. They're also responsible for education and outreach and working with people to ensure that these types of problems don't arise. So the Civil Rights Division, with some 250 lawyers, is one of the most important branches of the government, I think, responsible nationwide for enforcement of virtually all of the federal civil rights laws that benefit each and every one of us. And that was an important part of Bill Lee's speech as well, when he said, without fear or favor, that he would enforce the laws on behalf of everyone. I think it's crucial for people to understand that this isn't about self-interest. There are principles involved here, and that's what we've lost in all this partisan fighting, this talking about payback, retaliation. I think that's the real tragedy inside Washington. We all take this for granted and we're cynical, but outside Washington, people would be appalled, regardless of their political affiliation, if they knew what a handful of senators are talking about. You know, they're now talking about, because of this appointment, holding up all the work of the Civil Rights Division, not approving anything, cutting back appropriations, freezing the budget, not approving judges. It's amazing the level at which politics is conducted.
Professor Wu, let's talk about today what is going to happen. He has been named, Bill Lanley has been named Acting Assistant Attorney General in charge of civil rights, for civil rights. Now, this means, actually, Clinton does not have to bring this before the Senate, really, before the end of his term. But he says that he will. He will bring it before them for confirmation.
Right. And I think that's a gesture where he's reaching out, and that's a good gesture for him to make to the Senate. But Bill Lee will go to work today.
But doesn't this hamstring Bill Lee totally?
Only if the Senate makes an issue of it. Technically, legally, Bill Lee has the job. Just as if the acting weren't in front of his name. For the past year, someone else has held the job in an acting capacity, someone who did a very good job, and she returned to private practice in New York City, and she carried on the business of civil rights enforcement without any fuss. It's perfectly common for people to be named to acting this, acting that.
But don't Republican senators like Orrin Hatch, who have so vociferously opposed Bill Landley, now have him just where they want him? He is there, and so they won't. They look like they're compromising, but they have him in a box. I mean, what is he going to do on an affirmative action issue?
That's right. That's right. I think that's why it's important that two things happen, not just that Bill Clinton take this back to the Senate, but that the people, the constituents of these senators say, look, you can disagree on affirmative action, and we should have vigorous debate on that and all these other issues. But it's just wrong to play politics at this level. You're absolutely right. The senators could, if they wanted to, use the Bill Lee nomination as an excuse. It would just be an excuse and say, well, now we're not going to approve any of the dozens of federal judges awaiting confirmation. Or they could go back and say, we're going to hold up appropriations. We're not going to fund certain projects. We're not going to approve certain things. They could use this, and they've already threatened to do this, as an excuse for all sorts of things, but it's just that, an excuse.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Professor Frank Wu, an associate professor at Howard University Law School in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, a conversation with Gary Webb. He's just resigned from the San Jose Mercury News. We'll find out why and what he plans to do with his life now. And then we're going to play the second half of the speech we started yesterday at the end of U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's Seven Nations, Seven-Day Africa Tour. We'll play the end of the speech of Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Investigative reporter Gary Webb, who exposed the link between the Central Intelligence Agency and the crack cocaine epidemic in his groundbreaking Dark Alliance series, has officially resigned from the San Jose Mercury News. The resignation follows a settlement between Webb and the newspaper over a grievance Webb filed over his transfer from the paper's Sacramento bureau to its suburban Cupertino office. He was transferred after the publication of his 96 Dark Alliance series, which linked the rise of crack cocaine in urban America, particularly in South Central Los Angeles, with the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. organized Contra Army in Nicaragua. While the series struck a sympathetic chord throughout much of urban America, it also provoked a fierce reaction from the media establishment, which denounced the series. Following the controversy, San Jose Mercury News editor Jerry Sepos demoted Webb to suburban office of the paper. We're joined right now by Gary Webb from his home. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy. How are you doing?
Good. Well, the more important question is, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm alive. I'm here, you know. Well, and not working for that newspaper anymore, thank God.
Well, tell us exactly what happened.
Well, what happened was, you know, like you said, they transferred me out to the boondocks, and I went on a byline strike, and I wouldn't allow my name to be used on any stories while I was out there. And, you know, that made everybody even madder. And then, I finally had to sit down and figure out, this year and a half now since the series came out, and what am I doing with my life, and what am I doing with my work that's meaningful? And I had to answer that nothing was happening. It was clear to me that the Mercury, they had told me that even when we won the arbitration, that they weren't going to let me do anything worthwhile. They were not going to let me do any investigative reporting. So I had to figure, you know, this is kind of pointless to hang around and work for a newspaper whose editors you didn't respect and do dog bite stories for the rest of my life. It just didn't seem worthwhile.
Can you talk a little about how the arbitration went?
Well, we never got that far. A couple of days before the hearing was scheduled, there was a settlement offer, and as I said, you know, it suddenly became a lot more attractive than, you know, even winning the arbitration, I lost because I was still working for the same group of gutless editors that I would be working for before. So, you know, the settlement was you know, I thought good enough to take, and so we did, and it never got to a hearing.
Well, tell us about the articles that you wrote that actually never made it to the San Jose Mercury News, although they allowed you to write them.
Yeah, well, they not only allowed me to write them, they sent me down to Central America and then had me do research for a number of months and turn them in, and they were never edited. I mean, I turned them in, and nobody ever sat down and went through them with me. Nobody ever said, well, let's see the documentation for this, let's see your notes for that. Nobody did anything. They just made this unilateral decision that they weren't going to run them. And then, I mean, the thing that was shocking about it is when they made that decision and, you know, sent me off to Cupertino and took me off the story, Jerry Seppos got up on the Washington Post, New York Times, and then just lied and said, you know, there weren't any stories, which really told me that things were kind of out of whack at this newspaper when the executive editor can get up there and lie to the New York Times, the Washington Post about stories that he'd read, you know, and they've never run. And I doubt very seriously if they ever will. I mean, it's been almost a year since I turned them in, and there hasn't been any movement on that front as far as I know. So, you know, there they sit.
To say the least, Gary Webb, I'm very interested in reading them, and I look forward to your book coming out. But can you summarize for us, some of your findings, what you found in your investigations?
Well, the other four stories were primarily about the Contra drug pipeline in Costa Rica and the involvement of the Nicaraguans who were running the L.A. drug ring with the DEA agents in Costa Rica. They also involved Oliver North's role and his you know, enterprises, operations, and connections to this drug ring. They also involved an investigation into the DEA office in Costa Rica. There were allegations there that the agents were dealing drugs themselves, and it was a whole other facet of this operation that we thought advanced the story considerably. I mean, it took it from being, you know, what a lot of people saw as a strange sort of aberration that you know, a drug ring could have existed in the United States, to showing that it wasn't strange at all. I mean, there was another drug ring operating in Costa Rica. There was, you know, there was a very close and tight relationship between our, you know, premier anti-drug agency, the DEA, and the members of this L.A. drug ring. We thought it was significant. Jerry Seppos didn't think it was worth printing.
Gary Webb, for people who actually haven't gotten a chance to read your Dark Alliance, it has been characterized and mischaracterized over and over again.
Right.
A lot of firestorm over your piece. How would you summarize your first series, the actual Dark Alliance series, and what have you learned from doing it?
Well, first of all, I mean, I would summarize it by saying that the story was about a drug ring that created the first crack market in the United States down in South Central Los Angeles back in the early 1980s, and the fact that they were getting their cocaine from Nicaraguan Contras, people who were using the money to finance the war down there in Nicaragua. You know, and the fact that they had been meeting with CIA agents at the time before they started selling the dope and while they were doing it. And that's really all it said. Everybody else jumped on it and says, oh, you're accusing the CIA of creating crack to decimate the ghettos. And, you know, I think a lot of it was sort of a straw man argument.
I guess a lot of the criticism was, or some of the criticism was, the crack cocaine epidemic in this country in South Central Los Angeles would have grown up even without the Nicaraguan Contras back
then.
Well,
yeah, and that's really sort of a silly argument. I mean, you can make that argument about anything. The fact of the matter is that this is the way it happened. You know, there was no crack down in South Central. And there would have been crack anyway. I doubt seriously if it would have been on this scale in that city without these Nicaraguans who, you know, they brought in, you know, 50 tons of cocaine. And it's awful hard to start a crack epidemic if you don't have the cocaine to do it. You know, I heard a lot of people saying, oh, well, you know, this crack thing would happen anyway because people were poor and they needed jobs and, you know, blah, 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 blah. You can't start a cocaine epidemic without cocaine, and that was my whole point in the series, was these were the men that brought in the cocaine and started the crack epidemic.
Gary, so, would you have done anything differently had you known what you know today? And are there ways you would have written the Dark Alliance series differently?
Well, I wouldn't have. I mean, it was originally four parts, and, you know, they thought that was too long, and they wanted to cut to three. I probably wouldn't have done that. I don't know what else. I don't think I would have done anything else differently. I mean, I'm just sorry I had editors whose backbones weren't quite what I thought they were when the series started taking some criticism. But you can't predict that ever.
Now, an argument of a lot of the critics was that you never actually proved that the Central Intelligence Agency knowingly engaged in crack being brought into, cocaine being brought into this country, and particularly funneled into South Central Los Angeles. What's your response to that?
Well, that was another little nicety. I mean, we had uncontroverted testimony and pictures of drug dealers meeting with CIA agents. Now, whether they were talking about football scores or whether they're talking about cocaine, I don't think is much of a question. Whether or not this was approved at the highest levels of the CIA, I would seriously doubt. I mean, even if they knew about it, they would never be so stupid as to officially approve an operation like this. This is something that happens with people knowing as little about it as possible. And, you know, you can't prove anything the CIA does one way or another because you don't get access to their records anyway. So, I mean, that was another silly kind of argument. You know, people do newspaper stories all the time without proving one thing or another. It's not my job to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, I'm not in the prosecution business. I'm in the newspaper business. And my job is to put the information out there and let people make up their own minds. And a lot of people made up their minds after reading the story that the CIA must have known about it.
Gary Webb is who we're talking to right now, formerly a reporter with the San Jose Mercury News. He is leaving the San Jose Mercury News, has formally resigned. What are you going to do now?
Well, I'm writing the Dark Alliance book, which will be published in April by Seven Stories Press. And we'll be able to put a lot of this information out there, including the stuff that we didn't get in the Mercury. And I'm working for the California legislature right now as a consultant to a government oversight committee.
Doing what?
Same thing I was doing before for the Mercury, you know, looking at state agencies and looking for waste and inefficiency and corruption and that sort of thing. And doing it for the California legislature now instead of for the Mercury News and actually making more money.
Some might have hoped you would have maybe perhaps gone to work for Maxine Waters, who has taken up the issue of the CIA crack connection so vociferously and backed what you've been doing and perhaps continued that investigation.
Well, I mean, my partner George Hodel and I have continued the investigation on our own. I mean, we have not been doing nothing in the last year and a half. You know, we went back down to Nicaragua a couple of times, did some more interviews, dug up some more records at the National Archives. So we've continued to do the investigation, and that's why I'm doing the book. But, you know, the other thing is that everybody in Washington is still waiting for the Justice Department and the CIA to finish their internal investigations about this. If you recall, when the stories came out, they announced these investigations and said they were going to be done within 60 days. Well, it's been a year and a half now, and they're still not done.
That's right. I remember, actually, the former director of Central Intelligence, John Deutsch, in that historic, what you could call, I guess, town hall meeting in South Central Los Angeles, as he said, well, we have to wait until the investigation is finished.
Yeah, well, I wonder how many more CIA directors we're going to go through before we actually get the results of that investigation. You know, they were talking that it was going to take years to do this thing, which makes me wonder, you know, it doesn't take a year and a half to find nothing. You know, you can find nothing in 60 days very easily. If there's nothing there, what's taking them so long for the report to come out?
What about lessons around politics? I mean, before you did this series, you had never seen anything like the uprising that resulted, or people, the agitation, the anger, the organizing that came out of your Dark Alliance series. You ended up going to mass meetings of sometimes thousands and speaking. How did this change your life? And what do you suggest to people who read your series, were galvanized by it, demanded action?
Well, I mean, the one thing that really changed my outlook on it was how powerful the press can be when it's used in the correct way. I mean, when it actually tells people the truth about what the government's doing, when it doesn't pull any punches and lays it out there, people respond to that. The reason nobody responds to most of the stuff you see in the paper any day is because nobody cares about it. You know, the most difficult question for me was, and the question I was asked a lot is, what do we do about this now? Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot you can do except let people in Washington know that they were angry and know that they wanted to get to the bottom of it, because they're the ones that control the information, and that's probably the most difficult part about doing an investigation like this of the government, is when the government controls all the information, and you know, you get out bits and pieces and you never know the 99% of the stuff that they're sitting on. The problem was Congress was getting ready to respond to that. You know, if you looked at the hearings that the Senate Intelligence Committee held at the end of last year, there was a lot of anger and a lot of energy in that audience, and I think it frightened a lot of people in Washington. There have been no hearings since then.
I mean, no question about it. When they had that first hearing that we covered on Democracy Now!, I think they announced it perhaps that day or the day before. Wasn't this held by Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania?
Well, and Specter also said that they were going to continue to do hearings on this, and after the second one, there have been no more. And the issue has gone underground, and it's sort of gone away, which I think was the intent all along. I mean, this is a very bad issue for politicians in Washington on both sides of the political aisle, because, you know, you had a lot of Democrats who were supporting the Contras right down the line. You had a lot of Democrats that voted for these increased crack penalties as a result of this epidemic that happened in the 80s. So, I mean, there's really no glory to be gained by outing the government that they're part of. And I don't think you're going to see that. That's why I think this thing was shoved off to the Justice Department, shoved off to the CIA for who God knows how long, until everybody sort of forgot about this issue.
What about President Clinton? Has he ever made a comment on it?
He made a comment. I was talking to somebody who raised it to him at a party during the campaign, and he said, "Oh, that's a real hot issue right now. We're going to wait on that one." So, you know, his drug czar came out and said, "This is an issue that needs to be investigated," and that's about it. I mean, a lot of people paid lip service to the thing at first. And I think once they realized that opening this door, they were going to get back into the situation that the government was in the 70s, where you had the Pike Committee and the Church Committee, and you started opening CIA doors and all these skeletons started tumbling out and everybody got very scared and closed them back up again. You know, there's really no political gain for anybody to go poking around on the CIA's dirty laundry, which is why I don't think you can rely on politicians to do this.
Is there any chance, Gary Webb, when you work for the California State Legislature, I'm sure people are thinking now, actually, that's not a bad place to investigate the U.S. government drug connection in this country, that you could go on doing those kind of investigations when you talk about investigating state agencies? Any chance you could continue it just wearing this new hat?
I doubt it. You know, the stuff that I'm working on now has nothing to do with that. And frankly, you know, I've been doing this since 1995. And after I'm done with this book, I don't know if I'm going to be all that eager to jump right back into it again. And this is a very tiring, very wearing experience. And frankly, you know, considering what I've gone through, is nothing compared to what my colleague in Nicaragua went through. I mean, he had death threats, and his house was vandalized.
This is George Odell.
His office was burglarized, And he finally, you know, they finally left the country. So this is not something you really make a career out of, nor would you want to. It's very, very, very tense, very, you know, very scary kind of work.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Gary Webb, not only for being with us today, but for doing the work that you've done. We look forward to your book coming out. Do you have a title for it?
Dark Alliance.
Dark Alliance. Gary Webb, formerly a reporter with the San Jose Mercury News, now going to be an investigator in the California legislature, and we'll see where you go from there. Whether you would like to put this to rest and move on to other issues, I don't think people will let you do that, especially when your book comes out. So we look forward to talking to you in just a few months. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In just a few minutes, we're going to play the speech of Robert Mugabe. We played the first half of that speech yesterday. We got a tremendous response to it. And so we thought we'd play the second half today. I don't know if you have heard, but today South African President Nelson Mandela bid farewell to the African National Congress in his last speech as the Congress's leader. He said in his farewell speech in South Africa, apartheid-era leaders are waging a clandestine campaign to destabilize South Africa's all-race government. Mandela warned his party that some whites wanted to maintain lingering vestiges of apartheid to protect their privileges of the past. He said those who have not accepted the reality of majority rule were helping to instigate South Africa's widespread crime, acting to sabotage the economy, and using the mass media to spread anti-ANC propaganda. He then went on to say, quote, the leopard has not changed its spots. He said this of the National Party, which implemented and abolished apartheid and still represents the Afrikaner minority of Dutch-descended white settlers. While his wide-ranging 53-page president's report on the ANC cited problems faced by the organization, including corruption and power-mongering by ANC officials, it mostly criticized others for failing to work on behalf of the nation in the post-apartheid era. When we come back, we're going to hear the end of the speech by Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe about the state of Africa today. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Right now, we turn to the chair of the Organization of African Unity, known as the OAU. He's also the Zimbabwean president. U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright finished up her seven-nation, seven-day tour of Africa just yesterday in Zimbabwe. She is now headed on to Brussels to meet with NATO ministers. But we wanted to play the end of this speech because of the just outstanding amount of calls that we got yesterday to hear more from Robert Mugabe. Here it is. He begins by talking about Southern Africa.
The region has largely escaped the scourge of coups, although it has had its own share of fractious conflict. Together with other countries which have escaped or overcome the divisive legacy of colonialism, Southern Africa constitutes a nucleus for African democratic assertiveness and political hopes. Apart from the occasional strategic and related considerations, Europe's colonial enterprise in Africa was fundamentally premised on the quest for economic gain, particularly in the sphere of raw materials. This obvious point, which incidentally was well and unabashedly articulated by, among others, Cecil John Rhodes, is sometimes disputed on the grounds that some colonies, in fact, had very little to offer by way of minerals or other raw materials. In any event, as in my own country, the apparent absence of large deposits of the gold the colonial settlers had originally single-mindedly set out to exploit did not deter them from changing focus from mining to farming and ranching. The inevitable march of Rhodes' civilizing mission could not, as the colonizer saw it, be halted, even if it meant being opposed by and the killing of thousands of indigenous people. For land was still as precious as, if not more precious than, gold. Raw materials extracted from the African soil soon found their way by design to the factories of the colonial powers, even where processing them in the colony of origin might have been more rational, in at least the narrow sense of being more profitable. Colonial occupation thus became both political and economic. At independence then, Africa's inheritance from colonialism was an appendage economy, often monocultural, with rudimentary or even non-existent manufacturing industry. The task of our people and governments, initially perceived dimly but more clearly today, is to transform this inherited economic structure so that the people can fully benefit from the exploitation of their labor and resources. In the latter part of the 40 years of independence, we have sought to diversify our economies, to industrialize, to improve agriculture, to broaden the skills base through education and training, to build the requisite infrastructure to facilitate and enhance the process of industrialization, and to ensure that where necessary, these initiatives are well coordinated regionally and ultimately continentally. Since its formation, the Organization of African Unity has now taken bold and historic steps in the economic as well as the political spheres, with a view to according meaning to the aspirations of the African people in asserting their dignity. The adoption of the Lagos Plan of Action and its final act in 1980 was a defining moment in Africa's quest to promote economic, social, and cultural development and the integration of African economies in order to enhance sustainable economic development. It was a clear recognition of the fact that in themselves, the economies of Africa had serious limitations, and that for as long as each country continued to pursue her own separate and inward-looking policies, the African continent would remain forever weak. At Lagos, therefore, Africa committed herself to the formation and strengthening of sub-regional organizations as the first step towards the economic integration of the continent. At the sub-regional level, the Lagos Plan of Action, as later reinforced by the Abuja Treaty, found expression in the creation or strengthening of organizations such as the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, the Southern African Development Community, SADC, the Maghreb Union, the Common Market of East and Southern Africa, COMESA, and a possible Central African Economic Community as essential building blocks for a future viable African economic community. It was this economic motivation which led to the treaty establishing the African Economic Community adopted at Abuja in June 1991, reference to which has already been made. Africa's resolve to establish an African community by the year 2030 was reaffirmed at Harare in June this year with a historic convening of the first ever economic summit of the African Economic Community, comprised of the heads of state and government of the OAU. The summit decided that sub-regional organizations should now proceed to establish organic links with the OAU in order for them to acquire the true status of building blocks for the envisaged African common market. At the national level, many African states are currently undertaking bold economic reforms with a view to promoting sustainable economic growth and development. In a number of cases, these reforms have already started to yield positive results with economic growth rates of between 5 and 10% having been registered in the past year. These positive developments notwithstanding, Africa still faces immense difficulties in its developmental efforts. The burden of external indebtedness and the debt repayments, unfair terms of trade, low foreign direct investment flows, and dwindling official development assistance are serious impediments to its development. Then, too, Africa continues to wallow in the vicious cycle of diminishing returns to its exports of commodities and the rising costs of its imports from developed countries. Only a few primary commodities still constitute the main exports of most African states, since manufactured goods still amount to less than 5% of total world exports of manufactured goods. It has been estimated that the total loss of foreign exchange earnings to the African continent due to falling prices, particularly of agricultural products, by far exceeds all foreign funds which have been invested, loaned, or granted to the continent in the last half century. In terms of living standards, Africa's least developed economies recorded in 1995 an average GDP per capita of $78 in United States terms. In 1995, the highest foreign debt burden, constituting an average of 184% of GDP, was recorded among Africa's least developed countries, the highest being 443.6%. In the same year, the highest debt service ratio of 201.9% and an average of 39% was recorded for these countries. In these circumstances, the need for the international community in general and the industrialized countries in particular to support Africa's developmental efforts cannot be overemphasized. In this regard, we welcome the important initiatives on Africa announced recently by the United States of America in the area of trade and investment. We equally welcome the support being given to Africa by several developed countries, including the European Union and Japan, in the areas of infrastructural development. In the political sphere, many African governments have now committed themselves to upholding the rule of law, democracy, and good governance. During the past 10 years, over 20 African states have held democratic elections. Happily, the OAU has committed itself to supporting these processes. At the 33rd summit of the OAU held in Harare in June this year, Africa made it categorically clear that it will no longer tolerate or give succor to regimes which usurp power by unconstitutional means. demonstrating thereby its determination that the rule of law shall prevail in Africa, for these are values that African people fought for in their bitter anti-colonial struggle. Hence the action taken against Sierra Leone by suspending its membership and then appealing to ECOWAS to take successive steps against it because of the recent coup d'etat there. Equally important are the OAU initiatives in the realm of conflict resolution and conflict preventive diplomacy. At the continental level, the OAU has established a mechanism for conflict prevention, management, and resolution, which is now spearheading the search for African solutions to the crises confronting the continent. Similar mechanisms are being established at the sub-regional levels to support the continental efforts. In Southern Africa, the SADC organ on politics, defense, and security was set up in 1995, and efforts are currently underway to put in place the prerequisite operational protocols and structures for the organ to function more effectively. Zimbabwe is honored to be chairman of both the Organization of African Unity this year and the SADC organ on politics, defense, and security. In West Africa, ECOWAS has, through ECOMOG, succeeded in returning Liberia to civilian rule and is now exerting efforts to do so in Sierra Leone, although sadly its principal member, Nigeria, is yet to bring itself back to the path of democracy and civilian rule. Mr. Chairman, Africa's conflict management and resolution is not meant to replace but complement mechanisms for the United Nations Security Council in fulfilling its obligations under its charter. It is, as we are aware, the United Nations Security Council which, under the charter, is principally charged with the ultimate responsibility for the
You're listening to Robert Mugabe, the President of Zimbabwe, speaking 2 months ago.
As conflicts have flared on the African continent, the question of refugees has become another of Africa's problems. It will be recalled, Mr. Chairman, that in 1964, the OAU set up a special commission to work on refugee problems in consultation with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. Whilst the OAU and individual African states have worked tirelessly to prevent refugee problems from growing into interstate conflicts, the supportive work of the UN High Commission for Refugees and other international organizations, such as the International Red Cross, is to be highly commended. At the international level, Africa seeks to take its rightful place as an equal partner of the international community and will resist any measures aimed at marginalizing her from the international centers of decision making on matters of concern to the continent. It is in this context that African countries became members of the Non-Aligned Movement, NAM, and have joined hands with other non-aligned countries in demanding the reform and democratization of the United Nations system, including the Security Council. As the largest political grouping in the United Nations organization, Africa is demanding that it be accorded a number of permanent seats commensurate with its own strength in that organization, and these in an enlarged Security Council. The record of the past 40 years then, Mr. Chairman, is unavoidably a mixed one. In some cases, steady progress has been made. In others, stagnation, even regression, has been experienced. The lack of progress and the reversals that have at times occurred should not, as they have sometimes done, inspire feelings of pessimism and cynicism. Those who say Africa is a lost cause are plainly wrong. precisely because their view fails to grasp the important nuances of the developmental process in Africa. Those who attack us for failings that in fact are all too human show a suffocating degree of unwarranted arrogance. Those who expect us to duplicate in Africa institutions and practices they have created in their own political systems show a lack of respect and appreciation of our rich cultural heritage and the peculiar circumstances of our people. This, Mr. Chairman, is not a mere plea for recognition of uniqueness. This is a plea for recognition of the implication of the historic transition that was heralded by Ghana 40 years ago, which was a firm assertion of our right to recover our own history, our own personality, and become masters of our own destiny. Men and women of goodwill elsewhere should always and will always be welcome to work with us in as positive and constructive a spirit as they can muster. We, on our part in Africa, are ready to work with them for the progress and prosperity of Africa.
Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe speaking 2 months ago in London at an Africa at 40 conference. To order a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Special thanks to Samori Marksman. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.